minds aglow with whirling, transient nodes of thought, careening through a cosmic vapor of invention.
Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Mark Prendergast. He's just released a revised edition of his encyclopedic review of ambient music called The Ambient Century, From Mahler to Moby, The Evolution of Sound in the Electronic Age. And today we're going to be talking about the way that ambient music evokes mood and emotion and creates a kind of soundtrack for people's lives, which is inspired by the fact that I have music on in the background in my life about 12 hours a day. So there is a kind of way in which music becomes a soundtrack. Anyway, welcome, Mark, and I understand you have a cold today, so we'll try not to tax you too much.
Hello.
Mark's prepared a wonderful list of music called Ambient Music and Brain States, which we'll be putting up at the Change Surfer website, and it has a vaguely temporal order to it, so let's work through some of those. Let's start with some of these folks on the fringes of 20th century classical music, Debussy, Satie, Delius. What kind of mental states were they trying to inspire with their music?
The interesting thing about Debussy and Satie and people like that, and Percy Grainger and those kind of people in England like Delius, is that they were they sort of rejected the sort of major minor, the classical way of organizing music that had been sort of dominating since Mozart, the Haydn era, in making music. So we had a big thing in the 19th century called Romanticism, but this was like an extension of the same thing. It was still very much, there were still very strict rules about composition. The thing about Debussy and Satie, particularly, they were interested in Oriental music, which they encountered at the Paris exhibition that was a big exposition of culture that happened in the late 19th century in Paris, where the Eiffel Tower was actually unveiled. And they had lots of different types of music from various stalls or exhibitions from the French culture of its colonies. France had a big empire at the time. They had a lot of colonies in the Orient and Africa and stuff. So they heard this music played in a very different way, Indonesian music, Balinese music, and they thought, well, what happens if we evoke a different state in our music? And there's a spatial quality to Satie's music and Debussy's music. It has a sort of Oriental way of thinking, a Hinduistic way of thinking, rather than a Western way of thinking.
That spaciousness is what you carry through as a theme throughout the Ambient Century, as your underlying definition of ambience, that sense music that creates a sense of space.
Yeah, so we see an evolution from a very almost a very material way of looking at music, from the sort of classical side to a more sort of emotional and spiritual sense. You could say that classical music in America shifted from the West to the East, and that's borne out by the work of Reich and Glass and modern composers like that.
Well, were Debussy, you know, when he writes Prelude, l'après-midi, and things like that, were they actually trying to create a spiritual, did they have an intent to create a spiritual attitude?
Well, it's hard to know what's in the mind of a composer as he writes something. I know that Debussy, this was a poem, wasn't it? A sort of symbolist poem, wasn't it? Prelude to the Afternoon of the Faun, by Mallarmé or something, and it was part of that whole Oriental kind of thing that was happening in France at that time. People were experimenting with drugs, they were experimenting with drinking absinthe. They were starting to show more interest in what happened in the East. So I think when Debussy wrote this, inspired by everything he had seen and heard, what was around him, I think, yes, it's sort of a dream state is evoked by that piece of music. I mean, every time you hear it, it is a very dreamy, languorous kind of state, quite dense in some places, but still it has a dream in it.
Was there an absinthe music, you know, music associated with drug experimentation of the late 19th century?
Well, the musicians and the poets and the writers all sort of were sort of connected in various ways. I mean, we see like examples of Satie working with people like René Clair. He's working with people like Picasso, and he's working with all sorts of people, and. It's sort of interesting to see there's a crossover, and of course part of their whole milieu, their bohemian milieu was like hashish and absinthe. Yes, there's a languorousness here, a symbolism, like symbolist writing is part of that as well.
Well, we see with John Cage certainly a connection to Buddhism, explicitly to Zen.
Yes. Cage, though, is a very a rigorous thinker, almost a mathematician. So his way of sort of writing is people might think it's really sort of abstract and sort of loose, but it's actually very the whole idea of this kind of Zen thing of randomness or this kind of indeterminacy is only indeterminate within a very strict kind of, his classical education is still there. So Cage in some ways is more sort of rigorous than, say, Debussy or Satie. Or
you have in your list here Popol Vuh as a German spiritual ambience. What makes Popol Vuh spiritual for you?
Yeah, Popol Vuh, Florian Fischer, who actually died recently, very unfortunate, was from this, like, Bavarian capital part of the Catholic part of Germany. So his whole sort of take on on music was this very almost inward sort of journey into his some kind of spiritual high, and some of the albums that Popol Vuh made are very like the soundtrack for Aguirre, Wrath of God. They have a strong Catholicism in there, strong sort of religious aspect, which wasn't actually the typical of German music at the time, because you had people who were inspired by the industrial part of Germany, people like Kraftwerk and Neu and people like that, whose music was much more sort of machine-like and more typically German. Florian Fricke's stuff is very sort of hippie, very ambient, very spacey, very druggy, but at the heart of it is this deep Catholicism which he shared with Werner Herzog, who they both went to film school together. Interesting, you know, and that's why Herzog is always used. How I always used him, Popol Vuh, for all the films he made. So.
It seems like, in addition to the spiritual spatialness that a lot of this early ambient music creates, there is also the futurist part of it, the electronic part of it, the Stockhausen, the clanging machines, the kind of proto-industrial part of it.
Mm.
What are some of the music? Stockhausen's one that you talk about. What are some other musicians that fit into that? You know, the energy of the contemporary age. It's not trying to calm you down. It's trying to get you pumped.
It's trying to get you going, yeah. A lot of the, some of the early electronic music, I mean, are we talking about like early 20th century electronic music or 1960s electronic music? Or?
Well, there's a, it's all throughout, isn't it? It's, you mentioned Martin Subotnick as somebody in the 70s.
Yeah, Martin. Yeah, Martin Subotnick was that's an interesting story, Subotnick, because he's like from that sort of whole sort of San Francisco tape center kind of scenario, and he worked a lot with Donald Buchla, who invented the modular synthesizer, and a lot of people around a lot of things that happened in American sort of synthesizer music happened around the early 60s, mid 60s. And Subotnick even made a piece of music called Elevator Music. These guys were, they were part of the San Francisco Tape Center. They were involved with Pauly Oliveris and all those people, and inspired by John Cage. But their take on music was very much exploring the possibilities of the synthesizer. So in some ways, their music sounds like a lot of bleeps and squeaks, but some of it can be listened to.
Okay, well, now we're going to listen to a small section of Doubts About Waking by Paul Schutz from his New Maps of Hell album. You have here, just to go back to the mystical part of it, you have here Enigma and Mixmaster Morris. You call Enigma spiritual house and Mixmaster Morris mystical ambience. What connections are you making there?
There was a sort of an odd time in house music in Great Britain when it actually became allied. There were a couple of churches that were founded by priests, which actually involved the sort of whole dance music thing, and then sort of allied it with religion. And this kind of thing actually occurred here and was actually celebrated in an edition of Inspector Morse. This kind of, you're talking there about Enigma, the whole spiritual house thing, Enigma were sort of the leaders of it, really. This was a bunch of people living in Ibiza, but this MCM XCAD 1991 album was really, it was like sort of aligned the sort of old sort of pagan rituals of religion with house music, which was actually a celebration itself of a new religion, which was ecstasy. So there's a sort of a tenuous connection.
Well, that kind of pagan connection, though, it's interesting because I think one of the moods that I feel evoked when I listen to a lot of kind of world ambient music or ambience that has world elements mixed in is transporting. You know, transporting you to where the call of the muezzin is like, you know, you suddenly you feel like you might be in Marrakesh or something. And so the pagan stuff is like, you know, some Celtic element might be mixed in and you might suddenly feel like you're in the middle of Stonehenge or something.
Like people like the Afro-Celt sound system and the Sparrow's Frog. That's an element here in the music in this country, that Celtic element. I suppose the best person who's the person who's actually gone, who broke that sort of whole sort of mold with Western music, and was Paul Bowles, and then later Brian Jones, the Rolling Stones, because they let us hear sort of very sort of I would say like shamanistic music from Morocco, in that sort of the master musicians of Djibouti, and the person that's continued that on, that kind of more frenetic, trance-inducing, almost voodoo kind of thing was Bill Laswell, with all his recordings in the 90s, with his Axiom label. He had recordings of he went to like Morocco and recorded American guitar players with Moroccan musicians. He did sort of archive research on Paul Bowles' recordings, and then he sort of pushed that further by remixing and reintroducing those elements into the recordings of, say, Miles Davis and Carlos Santana.
You argue that Brian Jones is the Pans of Pipe at Djibouti is the first ever trance album.
Trance, a world music album, definitely. I mean, a really sort of incredible thing to happen. I mean, the Stones might be seen as sort of this rock and roll band, but they did have a lot of influence on the development of music, and that's an example.
We're speaking with Mark Prendergast. He's the author of The Ambient Century, From Mahler to Moby, The Evolution of Sound in the Electronic Age. I'm Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio. Obviously, when we get up to the contemporary period, a lot of ambient music has started to mix, has been crossed over into soundtrack, the creation of soundtracks.
Yeah.
And you give an example, one of your favorite ambient pieces, the Vangelis soundtrack for Blade Runner. It's obviously very well known. And it seems like there you begin to get very explicit attempts to create mood, emotion, and different kinds of mental states with soundtracks.
Yeah. Well, Vangelis had a weird studio in Marble Arch called Nemo Studios, which he built himself. He actually came to London to audition for Yes, but didn't like it, so built his own studio and started making records with Demis Roussos, and of all people. But he was quite a successful producer of Euro rock music. And then at this time when Ridley Scott was making this amazing film, he contacted Vangelis and said, can you do the soundtrack? And Vangelis said, no problem. I mean, most of Blade Runner is first or second takes. It's just him looking at the film on a sort of videola thing and playing various keyboards, more the CS80 and various things, but the whole essence of Blade Runner actually comes from Vangelis himself. The music is his own sort of very unique way of sort of filling notes with emotion, but not making it seem sort of in some way sort of ridiculous, you know, or schmaltzy. Actually, it has this great sort of purity, and even now, I mean, Vangelis looks back at Blade Runner, it's his greatest thing he ever did. He could never do it again, you know.
Moby's music, we've talked about on the previous show that we did together, almost every track off of Moby's most recent album, which is what, Play?
18.
That every track has been used for commercial purpose. So, obviously,
so I think the Play was, and then the 18 is going along quite well, you know, as well, you know.
Oh, okay, yeah, 18's more recent. So, obviously, you know, ambience is really, you know, the kind of edge that it brings to whatever advertisers are looking for and whatever movies are looking for. It's obviously seen as very useful.
Well, music's always been used in advertising, hasn't it? I mean, it's always been a part of advertising to use, like, you know, fairly sort of popular pieces of music. What's strange now is that you're seeing sort of, you're turning on the TV and it's a Jimi Hendrix track, or it's a Stones track, or it's a, you know, it's a Byrds track. It's like, you know, you're starting to see music, which I think a lot of us held sacred, is now being used to advertise all sorts of products on the TV. And I think that diminishes it, but then you could actually say, well, it brings it to a new audience. This is a good example of this, early example. This is Nurofen. It was a painkiller. Did you ever hear of it, Nurofen?
No.
It's a painkiller, right? And the only time that Pink Floyd have ever licensed a track was to license Us and Them from Dark Side of the Moon, which is itself a very ambient track with lots of delays and stuff, to Nurofen, a pain-killing sort of ad, which was just their music and sort of an image of a woman with the body of a forest. It was very odd. And so, I mean, that was like, people say, oh, my God, that's great. Let's use more of this kind of music. And so there's a couple of ads that started this, and then the way it went, and you get Aphex Twin, you get Enigma, you get the whole lot, you know. I suppose it actually, goes with the sort of, the current or the modern sort of freneticness of life, the speed that people are traveling at. Their brains are working faster because of computers, and sort of like ambient music used in advertising are in various sort of contexts, actually is designed to slow people down, as Eno said, get space to think. That's what people don't have these days because things are happening so fast.
Well, it's interesting to go back to Muzak and elevator music. We talked in our previous program about what the lines were between ambience and elevator music, but when you take like a Beatles song and you take out the lyrics and you take out all the jarring instrumental elements and you just leave the most ambient melody of it so that it kind of invokes that retro memory for you but doesn't have any of the other content, all it's doing is making you feel comfortable. It's reminding you of when you were 18 and making you feel comfortable at the same time.
We don't hear much of that here, Beatles stuff with the bits taken out, but you've heard it, obviously.
Yeah.
Is that a question, or is...
I hear it quite often when I go to the grocery store, you know, the most songs that have really raunchy lyrics, you know, in the real version, and then they're turned into Muzak, and you just wonder what's going through, you know, the programmer's head.
I think the ultimate Muzak has to be Rolf Harrison's Stairway to Heaven.
Right.
The Rolf Harrison Stairway to Heaven is the most ridiculous thing you've ever seen, and yet it worked, and it was on Top of the Pops, and it was a hit and everything. And yet it's so ridiculous, you know. I think it's the only version that they band like.
Well, Revolution Number 9 you have here is one of your ambient hits, you know. Just think about the difference between the the lyrical content of Revolution Number 9 and then turning it into some kind of supermarket shopping experience.
Revolution 9 is just an amazing thing to do on a record. I mean, it's just so avant-garde, it's so experimental, and it's like, say, taking all that Stockhausen and Cage and all this stuff and dolloping it right in the middle of the most commercial record you could ever imagine at the time, the Beatles album. And even, I think Stockhausen told me, I think he actually rang John Lennon and told him and really congratulated him on Revolution Number 9 as a great piece of concrete or experimental music, and yet people know that piece inside and out, don't they?
I really want to thank you for joining us today, and we're going to have the ambient music and brain states listening list that Mark's developed up at the Change Surfer website linked to this interview. And so thanks so much for joining us, and everyone should go out and take a look at Ambient Century. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Okay, then, James. Thanks very much for having me.
This is a piece called Austin, Texas by the band Pablo's Eye off of You Love Chinese Food. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.